two sides try to determine his status for the upcoming season. Favre added that he and head coach Mike McCarthy both agreed last night that his presence at camp is and will continue to be a distraction. Favre said he doesn't have a problem with competing for the starting quarterback job with Aaron Rodgers. Favre also admitted a competition, quote, probably isn't going to work, and feels there has been a lot of damage done that he can't forget about. The continued disagreement on Favre's role could accelerate trade talks, something Packers officials have suspected Favre wanted all along. This afternoon in Chicago, the Cubs are trying to rebound from last night's rain-shortened 2-0 loss to the Houston Astros. It was the second loss in 9 contests for Chicago, which holds a 5-game lead over Milwaukee in the NL Central. In the top of the 5th, the Cubs lead the Astros 6-1. The St. Louis Cardinals begin a 3-game series against the Los Angeles Dodgers at Busch Stadium tonight. The Cards are hoping Albert Pujols snaps out of his funk. He went hitless in 10 at-bats in 3 games, including 2 losses against the Phillies over the weekend. The Chicago White Sox plan to send Gavin Floyd to the mound tonight when they open a 3-game set against the Detroit Tigers. Floyd is 7-2 at U.S. Cellular Field and has limited opposing batters to a 172 average in 11 starts. The Sox have won 6 of Floyd's 7 career outings versus the Tigers. Detroit plans to counter with Nate Robertson. A federal judge has temporarily shut down a website that Olympic officials say is defrauding patrons by falsely advertising tickets to the games in Beijing. The judge ordered the shutdown today, pending a resolution of the U.S. Olympic Committee's lawsuit alleging the site is a scam. USOC lawyers say www.beijingticketing.com cheated numerous U.S. residents out of thousands of dollars by falsely promising to deliver tickets to the games starting Friday. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine, telling Champaign-Urbana's story to new residents and old. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed 4 times a year throughout East Central Illinois.
The housing slump has forced another home builder into bankruptcy, and it's one of the largest yet. WCI Communities builds luxury condos in Florida, and it's headed by billionaire investor Carl Icahn. NPR's Greg Allen has more.
For Carl Icahn and WCI Communities, it's quite a come down. Just last year, in a bid to take over the company, Icahn offered to pay $22 a share. Yesterday, when trading was suspended, WCI shares were selling for just 66 cents. The company initially rejected his offer, but there were protracted negotiations, and Icahn ended up as company chairman. Yesterday, in a release, he said the company was being forced to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy because it had been unable to restructure its massive debt. With yesterday's filing, WCI joins in bankruptcy 2 other home builders active in Florida, Levitt & Sons and Tusa. WCI concentrated on the high-end market, luxury home developments and million-dollar condos. Jack McCabe of McCabe Research and Consulting says WCI expanded aggressively, and when the housing market in Florida collapsed, the company, like many others, was holding too much debt.
WCI was always a very, very quality home builder. It had done a lot of construction in Florida, built good products, and this is another unfortunate company that is going bankrupt, but it's not the first, and by no means is going to be the last as we continue through the downturn.
Under Chapter 11, WCI now has protection from its creditors while it works to restructure its debt. The company says it's already secured a $50 million loan to cover operating expenses while it's in bankruptcy. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
With food prices rising and more people going hungry, many third world countries are trying to boost food production. But it's not enough to grow more food. Farmers need better ways to sell it. NPR's Jan Charles reports from Honduras.
Here's a question. If somebody says third world food market, what comes to mind? Maybe a street like this one in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. It's lined with people selling pineapples, vegetables, and everything else. But another kind of market is taking over in Honduras, the supermarket. This one, called País, is as bright and clean as any in the U.S. It's one of 2 supermarket chains in Honduras owned by Walmart. They're growing fast. Supermarket sales in Honduras have been increasing by about 20% a year. Luis Alfonso Andino, who's in charge of vegetable shipments at this store, says it's because people know the food here won't make them sick.
I think the most important thing is food safety, because we give them quality.
The supermarket revolution, the rise of national chains selling food with machine-like predictability, is an old story in the U.S. and in wealthier Latin American countries. But Mark Lundy, a researcher at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Cali, Colombia, says in the U.S. that revolution took 40 or 50 years.
In countries where this is occurring now, that time frame is compressed incredibly down to 10 years, maybe 15 at the outside.
It's happening in China, India, and elsewhere, driving big changes that reach all the way back to small farming villages. Increasingly, the key to success is selling to supermarkets, which means farmers have to meet some tough new standards.
Tenemos zanahoria, lechuga, coliflor.
High in the hills near the town of Le Patarique, Vicente Sanchez ticks off the crops that his farmers' cooperative grows. Carrots, lettuce, cauliflower.
Broccoli, espinaca, perejil.
They all go straight to Walmart. It's part of a deal that his cooperative signed with the supermarket chain with the help of a Swiss aid organization, Swiss Contact. Sanchez says it's a good deal.
It's a benefit. Because whatever we plant, we know that it's already sold before we plant it. We used to plant things without knowing whether we had a buyer, and we used to lose out.
But they have to be careful, because Walmart rejects vegetables that test positive for bacteria or high levels of pesticides. Ivan Rodriguez, who grew up in a small Honduran farming village himself, is in charge of Swiss Contact's programs in Honduras. He says the safety standards can be a big problem, especially for small farmers.
They have difficulties here to meet those standards because they need specific facilities. For example, to package product here, the best way should be having a kind of small warehouse with protective walls against flies, you know, but here we don't have that.
So Swiss Contact may help these farmers build a clean, fly-proof packaging room. It's an example of an increasingly popular development strategy, helping small, isolated farmers by connecting them to expanding markets. Edward Bresnian is an agricultural economist at the World Bank office in Honduras.
What we're working on much more today is not only productivity, but productivity for what? For the market.
For the farmers in Le Patarique, it's working pretty well so far. Some of them have just arrived at the Walmart supply center in the outskirts of Tegucigalpa, driving a pickup truck loaded with broccoli, green beans, and carrots. The Walmart manager here, Gabriel Shiriboga, looks pleased.
So good.
It's good?
Yes, it's good because it's a fresh cut.
Within 24 hours, shoppers will see those vegetables on supermarket shelves. And some of the money they spend will flow back to the village, a small but well-connected village. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Decades ago, table tennis players provided one of the West's first openings to communist China. It was described as ping-pong diplomacy. Now, table tennis may provide a different sort of opening at the Beijing Olympics. The United States will be represented by players for whom the trip to China feels like going home. All four members were born in China. That includes the team's top female player, Guo Jun. Chinese dominate the world of ping pong, though there's an effort to change that. Here's NPR's Frank Langfitt.
By athletic standards, Guo Jun is old, 39 years old. Some years back, she thought about retiring. Then, China won its bid to host the Summer Olympics.
I feel like, oh, Olympic in Beijing, that's going to be, you know, a lot of fun.
Guo used to play for China. In 1992, she won a silver medal at the Barcelona Olympics. Later, she moved to the U.S. to get married. But playing here was frustrating. In China, ping pong is a serious sport you can watch on TV. Here, it's something you play in a basement, like air hockey.
Table tennis in the U.S. it's really no good.
In fact, Gao says the competition is so poor here, she has to live most of the year in Shanghai just to keep her skills up. Gao's game looks nothing like the one you see in American rec rooms. Here she is warming up with an opponent at a club near her former home in Maryland. Her sneakers squeak as she slides back and forth across the floor. She flicks her paddle, firing the ball at speeds of up to 70 miles an hour. To get a feel for the Olympic-level game, I pick up a paddle.
Ready?
Yeah, no, I'm sure I'm not. Let's go.
That's Gal's reaction as I send her first serve sailing off the table. When she serves, she slices the ball with her paddle. It comes corkscrewing towards me. I knock this one straight into the net.
So I can't get it up over the net?
If you cannot read my spin,
then I can't return it.
No.
Gal remarks on my form. She's appalled.
Look how you hold your racket. It's like you're holding a knife.
Yeah, it is.
Beijing marks Gal's fourth Olympics. Some younger U.S. players think that's too many. Unable to make their national team, older Chinese players often go abroad and then dominate the teams of other countries. That's what Chen Weixing did. He now plays for Austria. Today, he's demonstrating a serve at Club Yola, a ping pong center outside Washington, D.C.
You must go leg spin.
One of his students is 16-year-old Amaresh Sahu. Sahu admires Chinese-born players, but he also resents them.
I think it's good for us to see their styles, but I think for them to take up so many spots again and again and again and just refuse the talented players here to go up to international competition is kind of wrong. And you don't really know if they're really playing for us or they just want to go play.
The International Table Tennis Federation wants to make it easier for people like Sahu. Earlier this year, it made a new rule. Most foreign players must live in their adopted country for a period of time before they can compete for their new nation overseas. The rule, though, doesn't apply to the Olympics, and it isn't retroactive. Richard Lee runs Club Yola. He says the restrictions may give native-born players more chances at home.
But the problem is when the U.S. players go overseas and suddenly play a Chinese player or a European player, they're going to get crushed.
Gao Jun admits that she takes opportunities away from native-born players, but she says fans want to see competitive matches. And often, that means Chinese against Chinese. With Gal pushing 40, I ask her about the future.
I think after 2008, I will stop. But maybe, who knows, after 4 years, next Olympic coming, I think, oh, still nobody can beat me in U.S. Maybe I start again. I don't know.
For now, though, she's focused on this month at the Beijing University Gymnasium, where the crowd will be a sellout and no one will equate ping pong with air hockey. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
It's 2:53. It's normal to want to protect special places in nature, but in some cases, these places are disappearing simply because of nature. Christina Morgan reports on an ancient spot that might disappear in our lifetime. The people who love it want to save it, but they might have to let it go.
For four generations, Jamie Bragg's family has visited a rare site, a bog left behind by glaciers thousands of years ago.
As a child, I used to go out there and play on it with my grandmother, and we would pick cranberries. My brother and I would play out there.
Bragg says her grandmother used to take a boat out to the bog in a lake in central Ohio. Her grandmother made pies and wine with the cranberries. Bragg is a lake historian who's worried about the bog. That's because it's shrinking. But before we talk about why it's shrinking, it's important to know what makes this tiny area special. Webster's Dictionary defines a bog as soft, waterlogged ground. And this bog, Cranberry Bog, is soft and waterlogged, but it's not ground. There's no dirt. The bog is a 10-acre patch of sphagnum moss. Most bogs surround a glacial lake. Instead, Cranberry Bog is surrounded by a lake and floating. Here's what happened. Nearly 200 years ago, crews digging in an ancient riverbed created a reservoir to feed the Ohio and Erie Canal. The reservoir filled, the mossy bog floated to the surface. How or why it stayed there, no one knows.
An absolute oddity. It shouldn't be here.
Greg Seymour is with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. He says the ancient bog is home to likely the only collection of plants of its kind in the world. More than 150 plants, a handful of them native to Canada. Nudged southward by the glacier, the plants are tricked by the cool bog mat into thinking they never left home. The bog is shrinking for several reasons. Waves from passing boats loosen the bog mat. Storms topple trees, which rip out chunks of the mat. But Seymour says the biggest threat is the bog's chemistry, which makes the site its own worst enemy.
The number one factor is going to be the chemical reaction between the alkaline lake waters and the acidic bog.
The pH balance is off, way off. Cranberry Bog is doomed to disappear, probably within 30 years. But area historian Jamie Brague remains upbeat, saying ever since she can remember, someone has had a scheme to save Cranberry Bog. And sure enough, there's a new group determined to preserve the ancient bog. George O'Donnell leads Friends of Cranberry Bog. He and others think one way to generate interest in the site is to inventory all the bog has to offer. Such an inventory is being done by the bog's neighbor 8 miles to the north, Dawes Arboretum. Tim Mason is the manager of natural resources there. He says even if the inventory and other efforts to preserve the bog fail, they have a plan B. Dawes created a restoration area where pieces of cranberry bog that break off are placed.
We can just hold on to what's there. It takes thousands of years for the peat moss material to grow. So to create, that's something that we would certainly not see in our lifetime.
Saving the bog or just preserving its pieces is a long shot, yet the efforts persist. Historian Jamie Brague is one of many people who hope for success. But even Brague admits, after more than 10,000 years, Cranberry Bog has had a pretty good run. For the Environment Report, I'm Christina Morgan.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
Earth and Sky.
Lenny Garente, a biology professor at MIT, is trying to learn how to manipulate the genes that could extend human life.
One guide would be to look what happens in the laboratory when you take a mouse and restrict the calories and give it this diet that has adequate nutrition but low calories.
Garente said a low-calorie diet below 1,500 calories daily triggers anti-aging genes called sirtuins.
That can extend their lifespan by something like one-third.
He said there's an evolutionary reason for this.
The thing is, when conditions become harsh and food is less available, then what these sirtuin genes do is they shift the strategy towards maintenance. And that's the state that would promote longevity and disease resistance.
Garente said a drug might be developed to give the same effect.